Do you know what? I've just spent the last 20 minutes just trying to think of something funny to say for the bit before the theme music, and I've come up with nothing. Literally nothing. This is it. This is the bit before the theme music. I sort of feel like I've let you down, but at the same time, I don't care. Run the theme music.
What's this? What's this?
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
What's this? What's this?
It's Christmas time.
What's this? What's this?
It's all humbug, I tell you!
What's this? What's this?
Well, says he, my trusty old Red Ryder carbine action 2 on the sharp range model air rifle.
What is this?
It's the Total Christmas Podcast with your host, Jack.
He's an angry elf.
Hello, you beautiful people! It's so good to be here. I've had a fantastic 2 weeks, and now I'm back, and so are you. So let's do the interactive bit. How are you? Uh-huh. Really? Oh, that is good news. Yeah? Wow. Fantastic. Well, that's great to hear. I'm very happy. Congratulations. That was a good one, wasn't it? Congratulations. So let's get in with the show. I haven't got a lot to start off with. I just want to say one thing. Do you remember last week I told you that I'd reinstated episode 1 with a brand new disclaimer at the start saying, you know, this episode is a bit shoddy. Listen to some of the later ones before you listen to this because it does improve. I got an email from Mary Pulte, who's our self-appointed podcast American mum, and she's put, "Hello, Jack. Per your semi-recommendation, I re-listened to episode 1 of the Total Christmas Podcast. Well, let me say, that is 36 minutes I will never get back. But truth be told, I'm glad you have kept at it, because now the podcast is well worth the listen." What is that? What is that? I made a big point of explaining that it's not a great episode in the last episode. And not only that, there's two disclaimers at the start of that telling you it's a bit shoddy. And then she comes in with that. And you know what, Mary? You won't get those 36 minutes back. Let that be a lesson to you. But truth be told, I am glad you have kept at it, because now the podcast is well worth the listen. That's high praise, isn't it? Well worth the listen. Let's just get in with the show. Let's go. So here's the thing, right? This segment, Christmas All Over the World, I do about Christmas celebrated in different countries. Now, I wanted to do a segment about Christmas in Scotland, but the thing is, generally, Christmas in Scotland is very similar to Christmas here in England. But I still wanted to do something about it, because there's something about Scotland, I guess because it's up north, it's colder, you're more likely to have a white Christmas. There's something about it that really does feel sort of more festive. And I thought I'd sort of look into it and find anything I could about Christmas in Scotland. And what I came up with was this story that I really liked, and I want to read out to you now. Though, this Scottish tale goes back as far as the 1500s. I don't know who it was written by. It's sort of like an old legend. And I'm going to do my best to read it out to you. And I hope you enjoy it. Here we go. It was Christmas Eve. The shepherd of a flock in a rural wilderness had gone away to a yule fair and left a young herd boy in charge of the ewes. Alone in a wattled clay hut, the boy looked out from the fire and saw that the short afternoon light was already fading. His master had left strict instructions that all the sheep must be in before dusk, for in those days they easily got lost, and wild animals sometimes killed them in the darkness. Also, it was wintry weather, and the snow might come. Pulling on a ragged jacket, the boy went out into the cold afternoon to bring in the flock. Soon he had them rounded up and safely penned for the night, all but one ewe. He searched and searched, remembering the shepherd's parting words, but he could not find the animal anywhere. The light faded. The last dark fires sank in the west. In the faint light that fell from the evening sky through the gaps in the cloud, he searched on, fearing to let down his master. At length, after hours of wandering in the darkness, filling his boots with icy bog water, scratching his face and hands on briars and the twigs of thickets, he stood once more by the little clay hut. Dejected, he went in and sat by the side of the dying fire. After a while, he stirred the embers into life and threw on a few twigs and a couple of peats. He pushed off the hard, broken boots and nursed his bare feet in the warmth. Soon the moon would rise. He would wait until then and go out again. although he had little hope of finding the lost sheep. Then suddenly he thought of St. Ringan's Well, which lay a little distance away. People often went there in times of trouble to enlist the saint's aid, sometimes people who had lost things. And it was Christmas Eve. St. Ringan was said to come back to Galloway every Christmas Eve. He paused. But the saint only helped proper folk. He wouldn't be interested in a ragged herd boy. And they always took him a gift. The boy looked around and he had nothing. All he possessed in the world were his few poor clothes and the bowl of kale broth he was to eat for his supper. It was hardly enough to offer a saint. Besides, he was hungry. Regretfully, he realised that hungry or not, he must offer the broth to St. Ringan. He just had to find the ewe, and he needed help. The herd boy warmed the bowl of broth at the fire and carried it carefully through the darkness to the well. He set it down on the stone edge. Then he kneeled, and fervently, though with an eye half open in case anything creepy happened, he begged St. Ringan to help him find the lost sheep. When he had finished, he stood up. Nothing had changed. He waited, looking around into the dark bushes. No bleating came to his ears. Through clear, widening gaps between the clouds, like tracks of water, the stars glittered frostily. A bitter breeze chilled his face and felt through his jacket. With a last longing look at the dish of broth, the boy turned away and began to walk back to the hut. He had not gone very far when he heard a noise behind him. Turning, he saw a thin, ragged man sitting on the edge of the well, supping at the broth. The herd boy began to protest. He had left his supper for a saint, not this tattered beggar. Then charitably he thought that since St. Ringan had not turned up, the poor hungry man might as well have it. The beggar waved his spoon at the boy. "It's a grand night, laddie." "I wish it was," the herd boy replied dejectedly, coming back. "I've lost one of my master's ewes. Some wild animal will kill it during the night, or it will stray so that I'll never find it." "Don't worry yourself," said the beggar. "It's not so far away. You'll find it caught in a bramble bush in the deep ditch beneath yon saw trees that always bloom first in the spring." The boy shook his head. "I won't. I've been along that ditch a dozen times and it's not there." "Well, that's where you'll find her." The boy sighed. He needed more helpful advice than that. The beggar finished the dish of broth and then together they walked to the place he had described. To the shepherd boy's astonishment, there was the ewe caught in the thorns near the bottom of the ditch, its walls screwed up so tight in the brambles that it could not move. He scrambled down through the tangled vegetation until the verge was high above his head. His boots went through the ice into the mud and water, and no matter how he tugged and tore at the thorns, the boy could not release the sheep. The beggar joined him deep in the cold ditch, and somehow together they pulled the wool apart, broke off the bramble stems, and hauled the animal up the grassy bank. But the sheep was so far gone with exhaustion and cold that it could not stand and slumped to the ground when they released it. The boy was not strong enough to carry it, and he looked down at the forlorn beast. "I think it will die here," he said, not far from tears. "I don't know how to get it home." As an answer, the beggar bent and, catching the sheep by the legs, slung it around his shoulders. And side by side, they returned to the little clay hut and set the tattered animal down by the still glowing fire. "Will you not stay here the night?" the boy said. "It's cold outside, I have nothing more to eat, but you're welcome to the fire." "Thank you, laddie," the beggar replied. "It's a kind offer, but I must be on my way or I'll be late." "Late?" exclaimed the boy. "But where are you going at this time of night? It's nearly midnight." "Where?" "Why, Bethlehem, of course. Where else would I be on Christmas night?" The herd boy was bending to pick up sticks for the fire. When he looked up, the beggar was nowhere to be seen. Quickly he crossed to the door and stared out into the cold night. The beggar had gone, but there, by the rising moon, was a glittering pathway that led from the poor doorway of the little clay hut straight to the east. So there you go. That was a story about St. Ringan, or he was sometimes called St. Ninian, and he founded the great Celtic monastery at Whithorn in 397 AD, and the legend has it that he returns to Galloway every Christmas Eve. And St. Ninian is recognised, in Galloway at least, as the patron saint of people who have lost things, particularly sheep. So there you go, which is handy really, because that boy had lost a sheep, so there's going to be no one better, is there, for him to go to. So well done, little boy, for going to the particularly St. Ninian. So there you go, and I read a little bit more about that, and there was a guy that was there saying that he sort of knew where the clay hut was, or he believed what he thought he knew where it was, and where the well was that the boy went to, or where it used to be, which is now a golf course. Anyway, that's This episode's Christmas all over the world, and it was Scotland, a lovely story from Scotland. And I found one or two other stories, so maybe I'll do another one in another episode. But right now, it's time for this. Here we go, kids. Didn't have a joke last episode, got a joke this episode. This one again coming from Christmas Jokes for Grumpy Blokes by Nick Harris. Are you ready? I don't care if you're ready or not, I'm telling you the joke. Here it comes. A little boy was heard praying really loudly a week before Christmas. Dear God, I pray that I will get a brand new bike for Christmas. His mum was walking past the door and she heard him. She said, "What are you shouting for? God's not deaf." And the little boy said, "I know he's not, but Granny is." Get it? Because he was shouting, so his gran heard it. In the hope that it's... Don't need me to explain it, it was very funny. There you go. That's this episode's joke. See you soon. Love ya. I haven't had this in a little while, have we? This is the segment of the show where my curious customs correspondent, self-appointed, Frank the Tank, sends me in a curious custom and I talk about it. Now, I tell you, there's one person who's going to be very surprised that I'm doing this segment this week, and that's Frank the Tank. And why is that, Frank? Why is that? Because you haven't sent anything in, have you? And I haven't got anything to talk about. No, Frank. No. See, the bit that bothers me, Frank, is that you, of all people, you actually did... I've got so many self-appointed people on the team. And when I say on the team, they occasionally send me an email saying, "Yeah, I'm your self-appointed whatever." And they do nothing. They do nothing. But you, Frank, you were different, Frank. And I believed in you, and you made me believe in you. And now look at this. I'm doing a segment with nothing in it. For shame, Frank the Tank. For shame. So... not last episode, but the episode before, I recommended Christmas Alphabet Podcast as the recommendation of the week. And that is hosted by a gentleman by the name of Wayne Clark. And I contacted him because he mentioned in the show that he is a pastor. And I asked him if he would do an interview with me where we could talk about what it's like being a pastor at Christmas time. And I've got that interview coming up. Here it is right now. My boys and girls, I've got a treat for you now because I have the host of the Christmas Alphabet Podcast, Wayne Clark. He's all the way from the UK, and we're going to be chatting now about what it's like being a you're not a pastor, you're a priest. What's the title?
I am a Baptist minister. I am a pastor of a church.
You're a pastor. Say
that. Yeah, I don't care okay. What you call me, really.
Not reverend.
I can be called a reverend, but I don't use that very much. I don't like it very much, to be honest. But yeah, pastor, minister.
I like pastor. Okay, you don't hear pastor much in the UK, I don't think. Anyway, Wayne is going to tell us what it's like being a pastor at Christmas in the UK. So first off, I don't think I've ever been, actually. If I did go, I was very drunk because I can't remember it. But I was interested to talk first off about Midnight Mass, because that's a real tradition for a lot of people in the UK, is to go to the pub on Christmas Eve, get a skinful of beer, and then stagger up to the church for Midnight Mass. Have you got any interesting stories you can share with us about things that have happened at Midnight Mass? And is that something you've experienced as well, the congregation being half cut?
Midnight Mass is more of a Catholic tradition, and it's not something really we do very much. I've been a minister in about 5 different churches, and I think in 2 of the churches we did do a midnight Christmas Eve service, a midnight Mass kind of service, but we always had a heavy on the door. We wouldn't normally have a bouncer on the door at church. This is not the normal thing to do at church, to have a bouncer on the door. You'd have a nice, you know, little old lady to welcome people, or a friendly looking child on the door to welcome people. But at midnight service, you've got to have someone on the door who knows what they're doing. Not necessarily a professional door person, but you've got to have someone who looks out for those who are a bit worse for wear. Because you want to welcome people, obviously you do, but you don't want people who are there who are just there to cause trouble. You want those who are still got full control of their senses.
Sorry, so can you describe this, the bouncer? Who did you have as the doorman at the church?
No one professionally trained, but someone who's got to be a bit discerning about people who come to the door. Well, a bit worse for wear, looking like they've just rolled out of the pub and don't want to go back home to their wife. Usually it's men, isn't it, who have had a bit of a skinful and deciding that church might be the next place to stay warm on a cold night before they have to go home to their wife and whatever's waiting for them at home. So you just got to be a bit careful. But you know, generally churches have got open doors and welcoming people. So we're not there to drive people away. But you've got to be aware that there's a lot of people in who don't want those who are just there to cause trouble. So that's the first thing I suppose you've got to have in mind.
But I wasn't really thinking about people trying to cause trouble. That was never a thing. You know, when people were going to the pub, it was normally, I remember a bunch of girls going one time and they're like, oh, we're off to midnight mass, and they'd all had a few drinks. But they just sort of went off in good humour. It wasn't like they were, you know, trying to cause trouble or anything. And that wasn't a Catholic thing either. That was, I think my mum used to go to like our local church for midnight mass, and that was C of E, Church of England.
Anglican. Right.
Yeah, so that surprises me. So you haven't done a midnight mass for a while then?
No, we tend to do early morning, Christmas morning. We do always have carol services, of course. Carol service is very much part of our tradition of what we do. Love to sing carols and sometimes do those late at night at Christmas Eve. I have done that in the past, but it isn't really something I've done very much, to be honest. But it's good to celebrate Christmas. That's something we do at churches, of course, is to celebrate that Christmas is, you know, we all know, those of us who do Christmas podcasts, that celebrate Christmas is a religious time but also an irreligious time. It's a secular holiday, it's a Christian holiday. It's a mixture of all these things, isn't it? It's a kind of glorious mess of all the traditions that we've all grown up with, and a Christian festival at the same time. So, I love the fact that we can mix all those things together. So in church, we celebrate the birth of Jesus, and it's also a great time to celebrate, a great time to have a good time at the same time.
Would you say it's your busiest time of year?
I think for a church minister, the busiest time is in the 2 or 3 weeks up to Christmas. And then once Christmas comes, you're breathing a bit of a sigh of relief because all the preparation's done, all the sorting out of stuff is done. And then you get the good stuff, which is the Christmas services. I love a good carol service. I'm a big fan of carols and of Christmas music and Christmas tradition. I have to be a bit careful not to be too nerdy. That's the trouble. If you listen to my podcast, you know I love all the facts and traditions of Christmas, and I've got to be a bit careful not to just land all that on my congregation and to say, did you know where the history of this Christmas carol we're about to sing? And I've got to watch out for the members of the congregation who are going, oh, he's going off on one again. He's going to tell us all about where Hark the Herald Angels Sing comes from. And we don't really want to know. We just want to sing the thing. And that's something I'm going to be careful about, because I do tend to be a bit of a geek on these things. And no one wants a geek all the time in their carol services.
Well, I think a little bit of trivia in between the songs is not a bad thing, is it?
A little bit of trivia. You've got no one to stop, though, haven't you, really? Yeah, I mean, I love it because it's all ages. It's the older folk who have got all those memories of Christmas gone by, and it's the kids as well. And we love having children in church at Christmas time, whether it's the children's carol service or Christmas morning, and seeing what they're going to do. All the classic nativity plays that the kids do. You know, lots of stories about kids who have gone wrong in nativity plays, and sometimes the nativity plays that go wrong are so much better than the nativity plays where everyone gets their words right and knows what they're doing.
I think when things go wrong, that's more memorable, I think.
It is. That's what you remember. And school nativity plays are normally practiced for weeks and weeks beforehand. But when we do a nativity play in church, normally we've had very little time to practice it. Kids are probably already worn out from doing everything they do at school. But we say, oh, we're going to do something in church, but we haven't got much time to prepare it. So normally the kids don't know what they're doing. You've got your classic, you know, adults pushing them into the right direction and saying, you go here and you go there. So we try to be a bit more creative and not give them too many words to say, and try and get the story across in different ways while still telling the story, and trying to encourage them to enjoy it and get involved with it in a fun way, in a way that they'll remember. Hopefully they'll remember for the rest of their life. And if it goes wrong, you know, it doesn't matter. It all adds to the fun. It's what it's about, really.
Mm.
So we've done, over the years, I've tried to do all sorts of imaginative nativity plays, like Doctor Who nativity plays. And
hang on, you're going to have to give us more. You can't just drop that. You've got to give us, what was the deal with this? Was Doctor Who a bystander, or was he Joseph? What was going on there?
Oh, Doctor Who arrived in his TARDIS in the stable at Bethlehem just to see what was going on. And got an insight into, for the 21st century viewer, into what was going on back there in the first century Bethlehem. So we had, which doctor was it? I think that was Matt Smith, actually. So it was probably, it was quite a few years ago.
Okay, so you had one, and was it a kid dressed as Matt Smith?
Or was it was all kids doing Doctor Who and his assistants, and so anything that can put a twist on the nativity play but still tell the story, I think I love to try and do something a bit different. One of the things I did that created the biggest stir, I think, was when we pushed a big box up to the front of the platform at church, like a 4 foot square box, and wrapped up in Christmas paper with a big bow on it saying "For You" on it. And it had been left there about 20 minutes, just everyone just looking at it saying, "I wonder what's going to happen here and what's in there." And then we got one of the women from church to come up and open the box. And all this time there'd been hidden in there a little boy. In fact, it was her son. And she didn't know, she didn't seem to notice that he wasn't around. And this lad jumped up out of it like a human jack-in-a-box. And said, "Surprise!" and gave the shock of their lives to the whole congregation. And the point we were making, of course, is that the greatest gift of all at Christmas is God's own son. And we were saying, it's a corny point, but it was a memorable activity anyway.
Yeah, but it hits home. That's the thing. If it's memorable, people remember it, and it's going to hit home. That's how you
always try to do something different and memorable. And
if it's not memorable, it's going to be forgettable, and that's the last thing you want, isn't it?
I don't take these things too seriously. You know, it's not about being glum and going through just being boring and religious. It's doing something a bit different, a bit memorable. That's what it's all about. And one of the things we do at church on Christmas Day is ask people to bring in a present that they've received, one of the presents that they've unwrapped that morning. Except that, I don't know about you, but we're in a lot of families, you don't unwrap your best presents until a bit later on in the day. I don't know, some people land at 5 o'clock in the morning and pull open all their presents, but you get those families who bring in their big presents, you know, their Xbox or whatever it is. But you get some families who have hardly opened anything, and they just bring in a little token present that they've received, like the woman who turned up with an iron that she'd had for Christmas and obviously wasn't very impressed with it. So someone else who says, "Oh yeah, I've got a present, but here's the presents that I got for Christmas." And you know, you got one boy who's showing off his Xbox, and the lad next to him's got a chocolate orange, and you think, "Oh, perhaps this wasn't such a good idea in the first place." Comparing presents, really,
not the best. Do you know, that's a real point of contention in our household. Anything from Santa Claus that gets opened in the morning, and then the other presents are after we've eaten. But my wife, she was brought up opening everything in the morning, and every year we argue, and every year she wins, which I'm not happy about. Don't want to get into it. So if I was there, I guess my kids would have stuff from Santa Claus that they'd be able to take into their church, you see. So what else can you share with us? I'm just gonna let you talk. Tell us more about what it's like.
One of the things I've done over the years is been involved with some big high profile Christmas carol services. I had the job of organizing the carol service in Liverpool Cathedral. I used to live in Liverpool, and Liverpool's Anglican Cathedral is one of the biggest churches in the world. The biggest church in Britain, and one of the biggest in the world. And I was responsible for leading organizing a carol service there and taking part in it. And I delegated a candle display that we had at the front to one of my colleagues, but we hadn't got a very big budget for this carol service. So she'd gone to IKEA to buy candles. And I'm sure IKEA is a wonderful shop and sells great things, but don't trust their candles is all I can say. They're not sold as what you might call church candles. They're sold as more of a quick burn. And she'd set up this big display of IKEA candles and lit them before the service. And there were 2,000 people in this carol service. And we realized that lighting these candles before the service started was not a good idea, because within half an hour, all these candles were flaring away. And then I realized that she'd set them up on a wooden stand. And suddenly there was a major fire hazard happening. Health and safety was obviously something we hadn't properly taken into account yet. Probably I was at fault as someone who was in charge of this service. But we had to put a quick call out for anyone who got a fire extinguisher to come and attack this big display of candles on a wooden stand. That was one of the scariest moments I ever had in a carol service. Looking back on it, it was funny. It was hilarious. But at the time, not quite so much. I thought we were going to be on the news for burning down Liverpool Cathedral that day.
To at Christmas, and,
having to evacuate 2,000 people out of a big high-profile city carol service.
Yeah, see, that's the sort of memorable you don't want to go for.
It is, yeah. But we survived that. But we did have a bit of a flare-up of all these candles. So just be careful of your candles, Jack, if you're going to burn candles on Christmas Day. That's all I can say.
We tend to stick to a scented cinnamon candle. Tends to be what we go for.
That's wise. And I think those kinds are a bit safer to burn as well. And then something else that I've been involved with as a sort of public Christian, I suppose, is taking the Christmas message out onto the streets. And I was once involved in a big, I think what it was actually was our town's Christmas lights switch on. They were in the town I was living in at the time, they were turning on the Christmas lights at the beginning of December. And a mate and I were asked to go and do a bit of a turn on the stage, go and present something on the stage. And we did a couple of different sketches and decided we were going to make utter fools of ourselves. So we went on as Mary and Joseph. We were two blokes dressed up as Mary and Joseph and went
on. Who
are
you?
Yeah, I was actually Joseph, I have to say. Okay. I persuaded my mate that he had to be Mary. So he put the blue headdress on and went on as Mary. And we went on and did sketches as Mary and Joseph, which was, brought the house down. I was delighted to say it did have the intended effect. But just be willing to make a fool of yourself at Christmas, I think. And that reminds me of the time that we also took a donkey around the streets in the run-up to Christmas. We dressed people up as Mary and Joseph and went round the streets. You know the story of how Mary and Joseph went for looking somewhere to stay in Bethlehem. And going around saying, is there anywhere they can stay, looking for somewhere to stay to have the baby? And eventually they found a stable to stay in.
Uh-huh.
And we got a donkey from a local farm somewhere just to create a bit of a stir and to advertise what Christmas was about. We got Mary and Joseph and a trail of people going around the streets and going into different shops with this donkey saying, Mary and Joseph are looking for somewhere to have their baby. And the best part of that was when we went into the local estate agents and took a donkey into the estate agents and said, we're looking for somewhere where Mary can have her baby for tonight. And the best reaction we got was from this estate agent who was looking through their files to see if there's anywhere that had a stable free. Put Mary and Joseph in. So they really bought into it.
That's good.
It was great. It was great fun and created a bit of a stir on our local high street.
Where was that then?
That was in Liverpool as well, in the suburb of Liverpool.
Well, not the centre of Liverpool.
That was in Mosley Hill in the suburb of Liverpool, yeah. So we've done quite a few of that kind of thing over the time. And, as I said, working with children is always lots of fun, trying to get them involved with the Christmas story in creative ways. One of the things that we've tried to do, in our church, we have a lot of people of different nationalities. We're a very international group of people from Africa and people from Asia, people from South America. So we've always been careful not to do, not to put Christmas across as if Mary and Joseph and the baby were white Europeans, were British. And we went on a hunt to find a baby Jesus doll that looked like it was Middle Eastern, because, of course, Jesus was born in the Middle East. And we found this this doll that looked like it had kind of olive skin. And that worked all right for the first year. But then when we put it in storage and brought it out for the second year, something had gone wrong with this plastic olive colored doll. and it had turned a bright green. So if you can imagine it, this baby doll, Jesus, who was trying to be multicultural and representational of Jesus, was a glowing green almost. It was a bright green coloured baby doll. But, you know, this was our Jesus. So we tried to use
it. You kept it. You still used it.
We carried on using it for years in the nativity play for the next few years.
The green baby Jesus.
This green Jesus became a topic of curiosity for adults and children alike. We had a green green baby Jesus. The children would say, "Oh, we've got to use green Jesus." So this idea of using green Jesus at Christmas started with good intention of not having Jesus who was white and Caucasian, but looked a bit Middle Eastern, but turned out to be bright green, which isn't. It looked more like Jesus was an alien from Mars, you know, rather than the human being. So if you ever see a bright green baby Jesus, you'll know that it might be appropriate for a nativity play, but at least it draws attention to this baby in the manger anyway.
It's true. Again, memorable.
Yeah.
So where are you now then?
Now we're in Manchester. I'm in Manchester.
Oh, okay. Oh, so you're still up north then?
Yeah, in a place called Gorton on the east side of Manchester.
Okay.
In a Baptist church called Trinity Baptist Church in Gorton. So I've been in a few different churches over the years.
Yeah.
Been a Baptist minister for a long time, but, you know, really still feel called to this and to celebrate Christmas and all through the year. But Christmas is, as you'll guess, as a Christmas podcaster, Christmas is my favourite time of the year.
Yeah, definitely. So have you got any other stories you'd like to share with us?
Well, I suppose the other thing I could tell you about, Jack, is that as well as being a church minister, the other thing I used to do is I was on the radio as a BBC radio presenter and producer for quite a few years, which I used to do, split my time between being a church minister and a BBC radio presenter. And
was it a religious show you did? You hosted?
Well, I started off working for BBC Radio doing a Sunday morning religious programme. But then I started doing more on the station, doing more programmes. They asked me to do different programmes, Saturday afternoon programmes, and then stepping in on different occasions. And one of the things I loved to do on the radio was Christmas programming. And because I am a bit of a Christmas geek, when other people wanted holidays, which was generally around Christmas, I often did radio programmes at Christmas. So whether that was organising a big carol service for the radio station or doing Christmas programmes. And my favourite programme I ever did on the radio was when I used to go in on Christmas Eve and do the Christmas Eve programme through late at night on Christmas Eve through to the early hours of Christmas morning. So I used to do Christmas Eve on the radio for however many tens of thousands people were putting their radios on as they were wrapping up their presents or getting ready for Father Christmas to come. Huh. I absolutely love that. That's one of the favourite things I've ever done is just sitting in a radio station, often on my own. Everyone else had gone home, gone off on their Christmas holidays, and it was just me and a stack of Christmas CDs playing Christmas music, talking about Christmas, and taking phone calls from people all over the place and getting them to tell me what they were doing on Christmas Eve.
I think that's what would do it, because then it's like you're sharing Christmas Eve with so many people rather than just you and your family. You're actually sharing it with everyone. And that's, I can imagine if you didn't have the phone calls, it might have been a bit sad. But knowing the people are out there and they're telling you what they're doing, that must have been quite a wonderful Christmassy feeling.
Yeah. So some people on their own would phone up while the records were on just to talk to me, just because I'd put the phone number out there and they didn't want to be on the radio. They just wanted to chat. So I could do that for just about between the records. But then some people were willing to come on air and come onto onto the radio for a chat on air. And they were fascinating, just finding out what people were doing on Christmas Eve. We had one couple who were camping on top of a mountain, and this was out of the range that this radio station would normally reach to, because it was a BBC local radio station. It would normally reach about, I don't know, 30 or 40 miles, but this couple were about 100 miles away from where I was sitting broadcasting. Because they were on top of the mountain and because the radio waves work sometimes that way, they could hear our radio station, and they were sitting on top of this mountain camping on Christmas Eve. And they told me that this couple, that their tradition was always to go camping on Christmas Eve. And they wanted to get away at Christmas, to get away from everything. Though they still had their radio and their phone with them, obviously.
No.
And they went out into the middle of nowhere, set up a tent on top of a mountain, and sat listening to the radio on Christmas Eve. And happened to, and I said, anyone doing anything unusual this Christmas Eve? I said on my radio program, and they phoned and said, well, we're just sitting in a tent listening to the radio. It was the most bizarre thing. They just wanted to get away from everything, away from the telly, away from the city, away from everyone else, and just.
I can sort of see that, but at the same time, it's not just cold outside. If you're up a mountain, that's double cold.
It is.
One year, me and my mates, we actually stayed out Christmas Day. We met up like late Christmas Day, and we all camped out. We had a fire out in the forest, a bunch of us. But I remember waking up on Boxing Day, and I was frozen to the bone.
Yeah.
So, and that wasn't up a mountain. You know, that was just in the forest. So goodness me. You've got to be impressed by that, I suppose. That's dedication.
Impressed by it, yeah. Take a warm sleeping bag, I suppose, and keep yourselves warm. But you have to be quite hardy, don't you? You have to have a certain mindset to be able to cope with that and keep yourself warm enough.
Aye.
So that's a great memory for me, just being on the radio talking to all these people. A lot of people are on their own at Christmas still. And just being able to keep people company. And that's the kind of thing I think brings together what I used to do on the radio and what I do in my church work as well. Just being there for people who need a friend, who need a friendly face, who need a friendly voice, and just someone who's, you know, bringing a bit of the old fashioned comfort and joy of Christmas. That's what it's all about.
Mm.
And being there for people, bit of someone who's not going to take things too seriously, but just going to say, you know, this is a time for joy, for laughter, for good news, not bad news. That's what Christmas is all about.
That is perfect, Wayne. I think that's the perfect way for us to end it there. So thank you so much for your time. Could you tell our listeners about your podcast? I've mentioned it in a couple of episodes ago. I recommended it. But why don't you tell them in your own words exactly what goes on your podcast?
Yeah, that was kind of you, Jack, to mention it. I present a podcast called Christmas Alphabet, where we talk about Christmas customs, Christmas traditions, Christmas music, some of it religious, some of it secular, and all of it beginning with one letter of the alphabet at a time. So each episode is all about Christmas stuff, beginning with a letter of the alphabet from A to Z. Z, not Z, because we come from a British perspective, but we've got a worldwide view as well. And it's just that, really. Fun facts, geeky things, but also interesting stuff about Christmas, starting with a letter of the alphabet at a time. And that's why it's called Christmas Alphabet.
And I can't recommend it highly enough. I listen every episode and I absolutely adore it. It's just such a pleasant listen, and it's interesting as well. That's why I like it. It is really interesting. Well, thank you very much for your time, Wayne. I really appreciate it. And hopefully I'll get you on again another time and we can have another chat about life as a Baptist minister at Christmas.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you. One more time, I want to say a great big thank you to Wayne for giving up his time to chat with me. It was really interesting and I really enjoyed it. And he's such a nice guy. And also, one last time, go and listen to his podcast. It's called The Christmas Alphabet and it comes out fortnightly and it's really good. I really enjoy it. And I'm sure you will too. The Christmas Alphabet podcast. Now it's time for this. What the Dickens? So I got an email from Scott Newman, who's my US correspondent and also the host of Jingle Jank and the host of Tinsel Tunes. And he sent me an email saying, the audio you are using in your What the Dickens segment sounds a lot like the Tim Curry version that I adore so much. If that's the case, I'm going to suggest a new What the Crap Jack segment since you trashed the narration. And I emailed him back and said, I'm glad that you spotted that, because it's true. When I play the audiobook segments for this segment, yes, I do use the Tim Curry version, which isn't very good. I don't like it. I won't lie to you. I do not like it. But the reason I do that is purely for Scott. It's purely for his benefit, because I love you, Scott. Now, I was quite impressed that he noticed that I was using that audio, purely for him as well. But then again, at the same time, he told me he listens to it every year. So I imagine he should be able to recognise it, really. While I'm talking about Scott, if you haven't listened to the latest episode of Tinsel Tunes, go and listen to it. They talk about Jingle Bells, and I've heard other podcasts discuss the history of Jingle Bells before. This one went into so much depth. Go and listen to it, because I highly, highly recommend checking out the latest episode of Tinsel Tunes. Good work, Scott. So, I hinted at this in the last episode, and I had an email about it from Dan Carlson of Burley Boards, our self-appointed workshop elf, and he mentioned about my favourite bit in the Christmas Carol, where the little boy in the street shouts, "Walker!" And I said I would talk about it in an upcoming episode. This is that episode. I'm talking about it right now, boys and girls. Now, I want to start by saying that I always thought I knew what it meant. Okay, now, in the UK, we've got a saying where people say, "Oh, stroll on," or they might say, "Oh, jog on, mate." Literally meaning, get out of here. You know, like, it might mean, "I don't believe what you're saying, just go away." I thought it meant that, like, walker, as in walk on. It doesn't, okay? It doesn't mean that at all. Even though it's used in the same context, that's not where it comes from. The problem is, there's a lot of places where it might come from, but no one knows. No one has a clue. So all I can do is tell you where it might come from, and you can sit there and go, "Well, thanks for that, Jack." So make sure you do say that at the end. Make sure you say, "Well, thanks for that, Jack." So the full phrase is actually hooky walker. So you go, "Ah, oh, hooky walker, mate." But it's shortened down to walker. So I'm going to play the bit for you from A Christmas Carol. Here it comes.
"What's today?" cried Scrooge, calling downward to a boy in Sunday clothes, who perhaps had loitered in to look about him.
"Aye,"
returned the boy with all his might of wonder.
"What's today, my fine fellow?" said Scrooge.
"Today," replied the boy. "Why, Christmas Day."
"It's Christmas Day," said Scrooge to himself. "I haven't missed it. The spirits have done it all in one night. They can do anything they like. Of course they can. Of course they can. Hello, my fine fellow."
"Hello,"
returned the boy.
"Do you know the poulterers in the next street but one at the corner?" Scrooge inquired. "I should hope I did," replied the lad. "An intelligent boy," said Scrooge. "Remarkable boy. Do you know whether they've sold the prize turkey that was hanging up there? Not the little prize turkey, the big one."
"What, the one as big as me?"
returned the boy.
"What a delightful boy," said Scrooge. "It's a pleasure to talk to him. Yes, my buck. It's hanging there now,"
replied the boy.
"Is it?"
said Scrooge.
"Go and buy it."
"Walker!"
exclaimed the boy.
"No, no," said Scrooge. "I'm in earnest. Go and buy it, and tell them to bring it here, that I may give them the direction where to take it. Come back with the man, and I'll give you a shilling. Come back with him in less than 5 minutes, and I'll give you half a crown."
I didn't need to play that, did I? I'm sure you're familiar with that scene. It's one of the iconic scenes in the book. But then pretty much, to be honest, nearly all of it's iconic, isn't it? Every scene in the book is iconic. Yeah. Anyway, here is where it may come from. Now, when I researched this, I researched it for a long time, but nearly every article I came across was quoting the same stuff. So I don't know where the original information came from. I don't know who came up with it. But like I say, it was just rehashed the same points over and over. Actually, one other thing before I get right into it, I got an email from a gentleman called Callum Crosthwaite, and he's emailed me saying, "I wanted to tell you about a book that might help with one of your segments. It's called The Annotated Christmas Carol and contains lots of useful background info about Dickens' A Christmas Carol and would probably give you enough material to keep that segment of your show going for years." Now, I bought a copy of that book and I was surprised at just how big it is. It's massive. You think, almost the size of like the Guinness Book of Records. You know, if you see the Guinness Book of Records in the shops, it's that sort of size book this is. Massive it is. And a bit boring, really, I won't lie to you. And when I did the research on
Walker,
it was stuff that had been rehashed, and I've got a feeling that parts of the article I read were actually taken from this book. So where does
Walker
come from? So the Oxford English Dictionary records it from as early as 1811, which would have been about 32 years before A Christmas Carol was published. Now, a guy called Charles McKay, whoever he was, I don't know, he keeps getting mentioned when I was reading about this, reckons that the phrase derived from the chorus of a popular ballad, but there's no evidence of that. Like, no one's actually knows what the ballad would be where Hooky Walker comes from. So that gives us nothing, sadly. It may have come from a song, but that's no one knows anything about the song, so we don't know. The other ones are from actual real-life people. So the first of those people was a London magistrate, and he had a hooked nose. That's why they would have called him Hooky Walker. So the hooky part is just a nickname. Apparently, because of his hooked nose, that's why the term beak is used to describe a magistrate. Now, you might not be familiar with that term in your country, but in the UK, that is sort of like a term that's used, you know, like you might refer to the beak, referring to someone in a court. So, yeah, that does happen. But they've not given anyone's name. They just say it's a London magistrate with a hooked nose, that because of him we say beak, and also he was Hooky Walker. They haven't given a first name, they've given us nothing else. So the next one is another hook-nosed person. This guy is apparently a Jewish guy named Walker. Walker's not really a Jewish name. I did look up where Walker comes from, and it doesn't mean you just walk. It's actually to do with treating cloth. It's a Scottish or Northern name originally. Anyway, apparently he was a lecturer on astronomy, and he had a phrase where he used to invite his pupils to take a sight at the heavenly bodies, meaning look up at the stars, and apparently his pupils would, behind his back, imitate him and like stick their finger out like they were hooking their nose. Again, it's not convincing, is it? It's that they've given us nothing to go on. No school, no name, you know, I don't know. Now, the final one is a little bit more believable. Apparently, in the Dictionary of Phrase and Fable by Dr. E. Cobham Brewer, which was printed in 1894, he included a note by a John B., which is a pseudonym of John Badcock, who wrote some dictionaries of sporting slang in the 1820s. Now, Badcock said this. He said that John Walker was an outdoor clerk at Longman Clementi and Company's Cheapside offices and was noted for his eagle nose, which gained him the nickname of Old Hooky. Now, Walker's job was to check that all the workmen were actually doing their jobs properly, getting there on time, doing the work they were assigned to. And if he caught someone that wasn't doing the right thing, he'd write a report and hand it into the bosses. Now, all the workers would discredit everything he said, and they go, "Oh, Walker," as if Hooky Walker, John Walker, had just made up these things and it was all lies. And because everyone spent all their time discrediting anything that Hooky Walker said, they removed him from his job. But still, from that point onwards, people still use the term Hooky Walker to describe something that wasn't true. Now, it's difficult because there's no way we're ever going to know where it really came from. It's nice that there's actually some details to this one, but the fact that there's so many details doesn't necessarily mean it's true. It's a tricky one, but make of it what you will. But I can say this, when people did use this phrase, they would like stick their finger in front of their nose, making a hook motion, as if it was like a hooked nose. So yeah, that's Walker. I still love it, even though I've no idea where it actually comes from. And now it's time for this episode's recommendation is a podcast by the name of Gastropod, and it is hosted by Cynthia Graeber and Nicola Twilley, and it comes out every 2 weeks, and pretty much they talk about food, and it's just really interesting. Now, I started listening to it last week. I've already listened to about a dozen episodes, and the first episode they just talk about the history of cutlery. Now, I'm not going to go into it because you can listen to it yourself, but I think if you listen to it, you'll get a real kick out of it. So check out Gastropod Podcast. You can find the website, it's gastropod.com. There's loads of back episodes for you to listen to, and each episode they talk about a different aspect of food and the science and the history behind it. I highly recommend it, like I do all my recommendations, so go and give it a listen. And that is it for this episode. Quite a long one because of the interview, I guess, but I hope you really enjoyed it. I'll be back again in 2 weeks' time. If you want to get in touch, I'd really love to hear from you. That's the one thing I get from this podcast, is the interaction with the listeners. So please do drop me an email. If you just want to get in touch, say hello, or if you want to ask a question, or if you want to give me a suggestion, I'd love to hear from you. So I'll be back again in 2 weeks' time. In the meantime, you know I love you. So Merry Christmas!
Ooh.
war